It, too, carried a magical blaster. It, too, was followed by a gust of foul wind. The appearance of another armed, apparently mutated stranger galvanized Moon Boy's idlers, whose rule of thumb was always to kill first and ask questions later. A hodgepodge of hand blasters cleared belts and hip leather on both sides of the street. The intruders stood stock still, at a range of less than 20 yards. There was a rattle of gritty clacks as single-action hammer spurs locked back. Then someone shouted,
"Yeehaw! We got ourselves a fucking muty shoot!"
The self-appointed firing squads took positions on both sides of the street. Aiming two-handed, the shooters thoughtfully angled themselves to keep from hitting their opposite numbers with near misses or ricochets. The figures in black armor responded by shifting position as well, standing back-to-back in the center of the road, each staring down a line of blaster muzzles. Oddly enough, the all-over armor plate they wore didn't seem to inhibit their movement. The material bent and flexed with them. The strangers held their own weapons at the ready, but unaimed. As if either ignorant or disdainful of the mortal danger they faced, the pair calmly waited for the Ville's welcoming committee to make the first move. They didn't have to wait long. No formal signal to fire brought on the withering barrage. When the first shot suddenly barked out, the rest of the blasters followed in short, ragged order. Volleys of pistol balls and buckshot rained on the standing figures. As the massed hand blasters boomed and flashed, dense clouds of thick white gun smoke rolled from both sidewalks, fogging the street and partially obscuring the targets. A stroke of dumb luck had landed Grubb Hinton in the upper floor of Moon Boy's gaudy house that same morning. A scrounger by trade, Grubb eked out his solitary living beneath the thick glaze of nuke-melted sand on the outer edge of Salt Lake City's crater. He pickaxed holes through the layers of thermoglass, then crawled in headfirst, searching the narrow, jagged air pockets for anything of value. Prospecting the wasteland was largely unrewarding work, as most of the wealth of the city that hadn't been vaporized had been turned into unrecognizable and immovable globs of slag. The work was also extremely dangerous, and not just because of the lingering high levels of radioactivity. Chances were, long before the first weeping rad cancer lesions appeared on Grubb's cheeks and hands, some other scrounger would have bushwhacked him for his meager bag of booty, or for exclusive mining rights to some especially promising hole. On the upside, he always had more than enough to eat, even if it was just rat on a stick. Grubb Hinton's jackpot find, a 1958 Buick hubcap slightly scorched on the edges, lay propped against the filthy, bug-splattered wall of the gaudy crib. He had traded this singular treasure for a rare all-night green beer drunk, and an even rarer, full 3 hours in the saddle. As Grubb's morning of bliss wore on and on, the gaudy slut in question had cause to rue the deal she'd struck with him. Even her most enthusiastic faked screams of passion had failed to make the little man finish his mechanical rutting and scar-fisted pawing of her body. The sudden thunderclap from the street that rattled the building's walls and floor and whooshed inward the shredded clear plastic sheeting that passed for window curtains accomplished what her ham acting couldn't.
"Stun, Gran!"
He rolled off the woman's doughy stomach and pushed up from the straw-stuffed pallet on the floor. Still staggering drunk and naked, a sickly, pale, two-legged, pot-bellied pig, hairless but for the fringe of reddish fur on his behind, Grubb lurched for the frame of the third-story window. As he reached it, there was a second floor-shaking boom, the tattered plastic curtains fluttering in his face. He pushed aside the strips of plastic and forced his eyes to focus on the scene directly below. Like a dip in an ice-cold mountain stream, what he saw momentarily sobered him. Grubb Hinton had come nose-to-nose with plenty of nasty, rad-mutated, creepy crawlies while rooting in the dark under the dirty glass skin of Slake City, but nothing like this. At first glance, the three figures in the middle of the street looked like giant black cockroaches, straight out of a jolt-binge, melt-brain nightmare. But on closer inspection, he saw they had two arms and two legs, like men. And like men, they carried stubby-barreled blasters. If Deathlands had taught Grubb anything in his 23 years, it was to expect the unexpected. If you could jolt-dream a living terror, odds were it existed there someplace. Generations after the new cost of 2001, Monsters that should never have been born were born, and once born, bred in awesome profusion. Norms like Hinton, lucky enough to have no obvious outward abnormalities, rationalized the hunting down and discriminate slaughter of their less fortunate brethren because some of the mutated human subspecies, known variously as stickies, cannies, scabbies, scalies, had devolved into crazed, senseless killers. As a general rule, mutie bastards didn't pack blasters. They preferred to do their murdering with fang and claw, with club or sucker fist. From his position at the window, Grubb could see the norm folk lined up on the opposite side of the street. A grin spread over his face. The intruders were about to be executed Moonboy style, and Grubb had himself a front row balcony seat.
Come over here. This is gonna be some kind of show.
He waved his arm for the woman on the pallet to hurry. She stepped up to the window without bothering to conceal her nakedness, but she did cover her ears when, in a deafening 30-second fusillade, every norm weapon along the street emptied. As the haze of burned black powder lifted, Grubb saw Moonboy's anti-muty posse scrambling to rack fresh, preloaded spare cylinders into their revolvers. Amazingly, the intruder still stood, their armor unmarked.
I could have hit him with a rock from way up here. How did all those triple stoops miss?
Then, with cold deliberation, the newcomers shouldered their own weapons. As the homeboys and girls tried to scatter from the porches, the roachmen opened fire. And it was clear at once that the assault rifles they carried were as rad-blasted queer as they were. Instead of the crack of single gunshots or the canvas-ripping clatter of high-rate auto-fire, the weapons gave off painfully shrill whistling sounds. From out of their flash hiders shot single narrow beams of emerald green light so intense that they could be seen in the midday sun. Everywhere the pencil-thin beams touched, they cut, and the slicing effect was instantaneous. The sprinting residents and spectators of Moonboy dropped, screaming, as they were bisected, along with sundry chairbacks, stucco walls, rain barrels, and porch posts. The row of rickety roofs collapsed. Out from under the rising cloud of dust, human heads, cleanly severed at the neck, rolled downhill like runaway melons, bounding off the curb and into the gutter. The battle, if you could call it that, was over in a few heartbeats. Frozen in place, Grubb and his female companion stared slack-jawed at the ruination below. Though every member of the firing squad had been chopped in two, the screaming continued. A few people were still alive down there. Grubb could see them thrashing in the dirt beside the collapsed roof. He recognized one of the survivors as Old Roop, the man who did all the beer brewing for the gaudy saloon. Old Roop's detached legs and hand lay on the ground 2 yards from where he writhed. Despite his terrible injuries, he hadn't bled so much as a drop. The stumps of his limbs looked blackened and scorched. Grubb and the woman flinched as thunder rolled again, and three more of the roachmen appeared out of thin air. They carried a different assortment of gear than their predecessors. Two of them wore heavy-looking, flat black canisters strapped onto their backs. The third intruder pushed a squat, shiny black cube on big wheels. With the initial pair providing cover, this new trio moved quickly from the middle of the road to where Old Roop lay thrashing. Seeing what was coming his way, the brewmaster flopped to his stomach and desperately tried to drag himself to safety with his one good arm. His considerable effort was futile. One of the canister men blocked Old Roop's path, the other kicked him onto his back and easily held him there with a boot heel on the throat. The cube pusher drew something bright and silvery from his belt. It was a cylindrical latticework metal cage, about 2 feet long, with a pistol grip. To Grubb, it looked like an oversized pre-dark drill stand, complete with battery-powered hand drill. Old Roop flopped around on the sidewalk, trying in vain to get out from under the boot. The cue pusher jammed the business end of the silver device against the brewmaster's chest, securely pinning him to the concrete. Then the device snicked sharply, steel grating on steel, and brutally ended Old Roop's torment. The mechanical cookie cutter plunged into his torso right over his heart, crunching through breastbone and ribs, and then snapped back with a fruit can-sized sample of red, dripping meat, which was quickly dumped into the matching hole in the top of the squat cube. The pusher leaned over the cube, intently studying its LED readout. After a few seconds, the Roachman looked up from the machine. Without a visible or audible command, the two with canisters began to move among the debris and the sprawled bodies. From short hoses connected to their back